BizNews Power Hour.
Well, good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 27th of October, coming from beautiful skies in Cape Town. I'm Justin Roberts. I'll be your host for this evening. With me in our virtual studio are my colleagues Nadia Swart and Jared Neves. And there's lots to look forward to in the next hour. To start the show, as per usual, our partners at the Financial Times delve into the latest global developments from a financial perspective. They go into a lot of US earnings with a lot of the FANGs, the tech names, releasing results, as well as stockbroker Robinhood. Obviously, a lot of hype there and a lot of parallels drawn to the Purple Group's Easy Equities. Their results are also coming out soon, so lots to look forward to from a financial perspective. Otherwise on the show, we take a snippet of Alec Hogg's investment portfolio review that took place yesterday. The portfolio has been doing incredibly well, generating compound annual returns of over 20% in rand and dollar terms since inception around 2013. But the big news is that Penny Stock Avenge has been added to the portfolio. It's the single biggest initial investment into the portfolio, 900,000 rand. The portfolio has grown from around 2 million to around 11 million in 7 years, which is an incredible achievement. That 20% compound annual return mark, that is the high watermark or what one should be looking to earn every year. If you're doing anything better than that, you're doing unbelievable. Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, some of the best investors of the world, that's the mark that they've hit. Alec has added Avenge. It's a bit of a turnaround story. One of the BizNews regular contributors, Pitful Yun, he's bullish on the company, and he has been since the company was 2 cents a share. It's now at 6 cents. Decorated mining executive Bernard Swanepoel was added to the board, and that was the signpost for Alec to add it in. Otherwise, I speak to Peter Major, Impala Platinum, releasing or announcing the fact that they'll be looking to acquire Royal Buffer King Platinum. This could be the biggest piece of M&A activity on the JSE this year. Royal Buffer King has shot up close to 20% today. Company valued at around $35 billion, and there should be a premium on that offer. Very, very interesting. Otherwise, BizNews contributor Bronwyn Nielsen, she chats to Misha Patel. Nods, you've done some work on the Misha Patel interview. What goes on there?
So Misha Patel, he is Sable International's British nationality expert. So he's a perfect person to actually give information about the logistics and the costs that are required and, you know, involved in the application process, which he says, unfortunately, is not actually that easy because Britain is, as far as he knows, the only country that has 6 different kinds of nationalities. So yeah, it's helpful for people looking to explore that avenue.
Very, very interesting. And then to wrap up the show tonight, Linda van Tilburg, or should I go back to March 2020, some of South Africa's richest families, including the Ruperts, Motsepes, and the Oppenheimers, they said that they would be giving back, as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, up to $1 billion. So this interview with Linda is focusing on the philanthropy of the Oppenheimer family, and it's sure not to miss. But before we get into the market report and news headlines, Jared, can you bring us up to date with what people are reading, listening to, and watching on the BizNews Network?
So here are the most accessed stories on the BizNews platforms. On our website, biznews.com, new brooms and power, Eskom's painful plan and outlook. Mauritius has surpassed SA as the wealthiest country in Africa. And Stephen Nathan on portfolio construction and Avenge are among the best read stories. On BizNews TV on YouTube, yesterday's flash briefing, the latest BizNews share portfolio update, and Peter Major on Sibanye-Stillwater's recent cautionary announcement are the best watched videos. And on BizNews Radio on Spotify, yesterday's Power Hour, David Shapiro on US Tech, Ascendus, Bull, and Sibanye, and yesterday's flash briefing are the most popular podcasts with the BizNews community.
BrightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Okay, Nods, what's in the news today?
The DA has appealed to Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana and the Treasury to create a new municipal grant so that metros with the required capacity can take control over local policing. This comes on top of the DA's drive for Cape Town to take control of local train services and the commitment by its mayoral candidate for the city, Jordan Hill Lewis, that if the DA is re-elected to control the city on Monday's local government elections, it will see greater independence from Eskom by relying more on independent power producers. Hill Lewis, who is also the DA's national spokesperson on finance, said in a statement on Wednesday that the proposed new municipal grant should be financed out of the current VIP protection budget. A former captain of South Africa's national cricket team withdrew from a T20 World Cup match on Tuesday after the sport's national body instructed all players to take the knee before every game in the tournament that's underway in the United Arab Emirates. Quinton de Kock, the wicketkeeper and star batsman, declared himself unavailable for the game against the West Indies, according to Captain Themba Bavuma. The decision was for personal reasons, said Bavuma, who is the first black player to lead the national side. Cricket South Africa made the symbolic act to show opposition to racism compulsory for all its players shortly before the match, its second of the tournament. De Kock has not knelt before previous games. And South Africa is considering buying the country's biggest oil refinery, a joint venture between Royal Dutch Shell and BP, known as Sapref. The state-owned Central Energy Fund, which manages the country's energy assets, is looking at acquiring the 180,000-barrel-a-day plant, which is located on the coast near Durban, according to two people familiar with the information. The government published new rules in September that require refiners to meet low sulfur fuel specifications by 2023, which will render most of the fleet obsolete, according to a lobby group representing the fuel manufacturers. Justin?
The JSE All Share Index was slightly lower at 67,400. In the currency markets, the rand was weaker against all the major currencies, to 14 rand 97 cents to the dollar, 20 rand 58 cents to the pound, and 17 rand 40 cents to the euro. Gold is lower at $1,794 an ounce. A Kruger rand will put you back 28,000 rand. Brent crude is low at $85.30 a barrel, and the premier cryptocurrency will put you back 930,000 rand. In the financial news, shares of mid-tier producer Royal Bafokeng Platinum jumped more than a fifth in early trade on Wednesday after Impala Platinum said it was in talks over a potential buyout of the community-owned miner. Royal Bafokeng listed on the JSE in 2010, where it was valued at 27.4 billion before markets opened on Wednesday. In early trade, Royal had surged 22.25% to 115 rand a share, on track for its best day in almost 3 years, and adding about 6 billion rand to its market value. The miner said in a joint statement on Wednesday that discussions were ongoing that could see Implats acquire all of Royal's ordinary shares in issue, barring treasury shares, which would see the mid-tier miner delist. Implats, valued at 175 billion on the JSE, did not provide any details of pricing in its cautionary announcement, and the talks do not represent an offer or a firm intention to make an offer.
This daily market report was made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Today is Wednesday, October 27th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Robinhood missed the mark with its latest earnings, while Google's parent company Alphabet exceeded expectations. And UK Chancellor Rishi Sunak will unveil his country's budget today. We'll chat with the FT's Chris Giles about what he's looking for. Plus, Poland's feud with the EU has been escalating.
I would say it is probably, you know, one of the lowest points, if not the lowest point, during Poland's membership of the EU.
And it's not clear how Brussels and Warsaw can find room for compromise. I'm Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need. Robinhood did not make off like a bandit last quarter. The company was at the center of the retail trading wave. It listed on the stock market at the end of July, and it was expected to rake in $423 million in revenue for the third quarter. But yesterday, the internet broker announced earnings that fell $60 million short. The FT's investment reporter Madison Derbyshire says Robinhood's a little bit of a victim of its own success.
So Robinhood's in a pretty tough spot where they've had a pretty unbelievable year of growth, setting all kinds of records, which makes it really hard for them to make that sustainable. So their revenues from cryptocurrency trading fell almost 80% from the second quarter when there was record-setting volumes, but that's still up 800% from this time last year. One of the things that Robinhood said on their call is they don't see their growth necessarily as linear. It's really hard to maintain the kind of record-setting volumes that we saw in the first half of the year with the whole GameStop trading craze and pandemic-induced retail participation in the markets.
Madison Derbyshire is the FT's U.S. investment correspondent. Meanwhile, Google's parent company Alphabet smashed Wall Street's third quarter profit expectations. The company reported that its revenues rose 40% year on year to more than $65 billion. Driving those profits were stronger than expected advertising revenues. Apparently, the company's cashing in on a rebound in search traffic, especially searches related to travel. Google was not affected by Apple's new privacy policy allowing users to limit ad tracking. Apple's move has hurt other internet companies, but Google has its own trove of personal data. But it wasn't all great news. Apple's cloud division fell just short of Wall Street expectations. The company shares were down 2% in after-hours trading. Today, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer will present the UK budget. Rishi Sunak is expected to brandish new forecasts showing the economy grew faster than expected this year. That'll help him trumpet his investment priorities. Here's the FT's economics editor, Chris Giles, who's covering the budget.
Well, I'm going to be watching very closely some of the forecasts for things like inflation. I'm going to be looking very closely at what's happening to public spending, particularly in the departments we don't know about. The UK government really is almost a big health service and then has other services attached, but health services now 40% of total public spending. So we want to see what's happening to other government departments because we already know what's going to happen on the health side. And I'm just going to be looking very closely at what the forecasts say about how much long-term damage there is from the pandemic. The independent forecaster was saying in March it was going to be about 3% of national income hit. Most advanced economies expect things to be rather better than that.
You know, Chris, it kind of feels like Chancellor Sunak is constantly being thrown curveballs, right? Like, first there was the pandemic as he was taking office. Now he's contending with these post-pandemic inflationary pressures. It's just like one thing after the other.
It is. And remember that the UK is a special case when it does budgets. Nearly every country, any sensible country, does it as a process over a series of weeks. People understand it. It's not a big secret. Whereas in the UK, essentially, it's a one-day thing. Everything is supposed to be secret in advance. That's sort of gone by the wayside a little bit in recent years. And then everything is decided on one day. The country has a big Conservative majority in Parliament. Nothing will be changed. So there's no discussion beforehand. Big announcement, big parliamentary event, and then a vote, and it will go through.
Chris, right now, how much does politics weigh into the drafting of this budget?
Oh, hugely. Politics is always massively important in these budgets. The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, says, this isn't austerity, but I'm going to be pretty tough with public spending departments. We've already seen quite a lot of tax increases, which have already been announced to help pay for some of the problems arising from the pandemic and to pay for catch-up spending after the pandemic. So politics demands it be quite tight now, hoping that the news gets better in the future so that before the next election, he has room for quite big potential tax cuts or more spending to make everyone feel a little bit happier.
Chris Giles is the FT's economics editor. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Mark.
Poland was once seen as the great success of the EU's eastern expansion. Poland joined the bloc in 2004, and the move helped drive a sustained economic boom. But now Warsaw and Brussels are on a collision course. They've been clashing over migration, LGBTQ rights, and now over the rule of law.
I would say it is probably, you know, one of the lowest points, if not the lowest point, during Poland's membership of the EU.
That's our correspondent in Warsaw, James Schotter. He says the feud started about 6 years ago with a change in Poland's government.
In 2015, Law and Justice, which is a sort of conservative nationalist party, came to power. They have a different view of the EU from their predecessors. They're more Eurosceptic. They're very focused on national sovereignty. And since then, relations have begun to deteriorate. But the one fight that has run through has been this battle over the rule of law.
James, can you unpack what this rule of law issue, actually is?
Yeah, so the EU requires of its members that they have independent judicial systems. And basically, since Law and Justice came to power in 2015, the government has embarked on a series of reforms that basically give politicians broader and broader sway over the judiciary. They've also introduced a new disciplinary regime for judges that allows judges to be punished for the content of their rulings. And the EU basically regards these changes as a fundamental threat to the independence of the judiciary in Poland. And, as the EU is above all a legal order, they regard having a member state without an independent judiciary as a fundamental threat to the functioning of the bloc.
So how has the EU responded to Poland's moves?
Well, they've adopted different approaches as this fight has gone on. So the EU tried to use a procedure called the Article 7 procedure, which ultimately, if you get to the end of it, allows for member states' voting rights in the EU to be suspended. That was always seen as the nuclear option. But the problem from the point of view of the European Commission is that it requires unanimity among member states. And Hungary, which is a close ally of Poland, has made clear that it will veto any attempt to use that mechanism. Since then, the approach that the Commission has been taking has been to take Poland to the Court of Justice of the EU, so the EU's top court. And that court has indeed ordered Poland to reverse various elements of its judicial overhaul.
And then, as we've reported, the EU put more pressure on Warsaw by delaying the approval of Poland's 36 billion euro post-COVID recovery package. And then Poland shot back with its own threat, right?
Like all member states, they have a veto on anything that the EU wants to do that requires unanimity. And when it became clear that the EU was going to take a hard line on Poland, various politicians from the ruling camp made clear that Poland could respond by blocking key parts of the EU's agenda. I mean, the Green Deal is one element that politicians in Warsaw have raised.
Could we see Poland leave the EU, James?
I think in the short term, it's very unlikely for various reasons. One is that member states can't be expelled, so there's no way anyone can force them out. And on the other hand, Polish support for membership of the EU is incredibly high. I mean, poll after poll suggests that 80, 85, 90% of Poles want to stay in the EU.
James Schotter is the FT's Central Europe correspondent. Thank you, James.
Thanks so much.
You can read more on all of these stories at FT.com. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
At the BizNews Investment Portfolio Review, Alec Hogg outlines his thesis for adding embroiled construction company Avenge into the portfolio. The investment is the single largest initial investment into a single company in the portfolio, with Avenge constituting 8%. This comes after decorated mining executive Bernard Swanepoel was appointed to the board, and with fund manager and regular BizNews contributor Piet Viljoen bullish on the penny stock.
Okay, let's talk about Avenge. Hey, Stu, have you bought Avenge, I think?
I followed Piet. He's mentioned it at the first conference, I think, the business investment conference, and he said it was a good punt back then. So I did follow Piet into Avenge early.
A good punt. A good investment, I think he said. Because what
exactly. So
what Piet says is, he says you buy a bundle of twigs.
Yes,
and in the bundle, he says, imagine you buy these companies that some might go bankrupt, others might perform extraordinarily. And he bought this stock, Avenge, at the time that many people thought it was going bust. And then during one of the Power Hour interviews, fairly recently, He said, no, he still thinks it's very cheap because he bought it when it was going to go bust. And then so he said it's very cheap. So what did I do? Go and started researching it. And then Bernard Swanepoel. Now I've got a confession to make. He's a very close friend of mine. We've been friends for many years. I don't have many friends who are top business people. I could call maybe three. I just don't, when you're a financial journalist, you don't really get too close to people that you might have to interview. But Bernard is now, he's a private citizen. He left Harmony many years ago and he runs the Joburg in Darba. He's also, as I say, a good friend of mine and one of the smartest guys I know. Anyway, Bernard has just joined the board of Avenge. So we got Pitt on the one hand, who's been saying to us, who's one of the great investment minds in South Africa. He's saying that Avenge is still very cheap. Bernard joins the board. Now, Bernard doesn't waste his time. He will go somewhere if he can add value. And he's done that in every board that he's joined. He was on the Sunlum board. I wrote a newsletter about this a little while ago.
You mentioned the three company boards that he was on, Impala, Sunlum, and there was another one. And the value appreciation in his time at those boards. I'll actually put the
link. Omnia. Yeah, good idea to put the link up there. It was a premium newsletter. So hopefully, you opened that newsletter on that day. I said the non-exec, who has got an incredible track record. And well, Bernard's, he's recently turned 60. So he doesn't want to waste his time. He doesn't need the director's fees, I can assure you, either. So he's gone along to make a difference. And he's only on Impala Platinum's board, Omnia's board, and now Avenger's board. So I haven't spoken to him about Avenger. I mean, that would be that would not be right. You don't do that to your friends. You don't put them in the middle. But I know him well enough to say, this man, he's smart. If he thinks it's worth looking or going onto their board, well, then you, Mr. Hogg, pick up the annual report and read it, which I did. And the annual report is very instructive. Philip Hawkerby is the chairman. Now, Philip is a former Ernst & Young senior partner here in South Africa, went to London, where I think he's the senior partner for the UK. Anyway, he's got a very, very senior position at Ernst & Young. Philip is an absolute class act, comes from KwaZulu-Natal. And he is the chairman now of Avenge. So that's a big tick. The chief executive, Flanagan, is well known in the construction industry as being a maverick. And I love mavericks. I love people who have fun at what they do and do things differently and make things happen. He does too. And then I looked at the underlying business here. And you've got two companies. You've got a company called McConnell Dowell, which is a Australian-based construction business. And then Moorman's, which is a South African, it's the South African construction business that Avenge has left. Remember, they went through a really rough time, and you'll see that in a moment in the graphs. But Moorman's is a mining contractor. So ask yourself, is Moorman's going to have lots of business in the future? If you, for instance, sometimes we look at Wilson Bailey and we think, my goodness, if the infrastructure plan of the government, the South African government doesn't come to fruition, then there might not be that many roads or bridges to build and certainly not that many office buildings, etc. So although I love Wilson Bailey, and I still think it's the last man standing in the South African construction industry, you always benefit exponentially more if you're the last man there. That's the, if you were going to build a building like the Amazon building in Cape Town, who do you give the construction work to? You don't just go to the guy around the corner or some organization that's just started. You go to the blue chip. And who's the blue chip? Wilson Bailey. Who's building Amazon's building in Cape Town? Wilson Bailey. So at some point in time, we'll see, the benefits going to Wilson Bailey. But another thing is Wilson Bailey also has a huge Australian operation, which is bigger than the South African operation. Avenge has got a huge Australian operation, which is bigger than the South African operation. Isn't that interesting? So where Wilson Bailey in South Africa has to think about bridges, roads, office buildings, factories, etc., Moorman's is very focused in the mining contracting field, and that's booming. So as long as the commodity prices are firm, this company, Moorman's, that side of Avenge, is going to be enjoying a very good time. And indeed it has been. But what got me even more excited about this business? So we start off by saying, okay, the people. Who are the people involved? The people are top quality. Then you look at this graph. I have to pull it out of the annual report. And this tells us everything. If you look back, look at the one on the right-hand side. In 2018, there were suggestions that Avenge would actually not survive. We've seen what happened to Group 5, Basil Reed. A number of South African companies have gone to the wall in the construction sector. And certainly in 2018, Avenge was one of those that was teetering. In 2019, you can see the financial year to end June 2019. When you look on the right-hand side table, both McConnell Dowell made a small profit, the Australian operation, but Moorman's, the South African operation, lost money, and the other businesses in Avenge, which have now been disposed of mostly, lost a lot of money as well. So you're sitting there at a loss in Avenge of over 600 million rand in 2019. But they put together a plan in 2018 how they were going to turn the business around. So remember this. This is a plan that started in 2018. 2019, big losses again. 2020, you saw losses, but much smaller. And then you could probably be as clever as Piet Viljoen and then say, look, I can see the trend. I've looked at this company. It's going in the right direction. Now's the time to buy in 2020. And of course, as Stuart said, that's what he suggested to us at the investment conference. And please do book for the next investment conference. We've got a fantastic lineup, and including a investment masterclass with Pitt and David Shapiro. Anyway, all the details are on the website on biznews.com. Just Google Biznews Investment Conference. You'll get all the details you need there. But then look at the next thing. This is to June 2021. That's why the annual report has only recently been issued. Suddenly you've got a company that's got the stuff it's going to get rid of, losing 122 million. But the two core businesses, if you add those together, they're making 550 million rands now. Suddenly you've got a very, very exciting operation. When you look forward for both McConnell Dowell and Moorman's, the prospects are excellent. Now, why would the share price have done this? This was a stock that was at 65 rands a share at one point. It's now 6 cents. In 2018, the plans were made. You had little upticks as some investors got excited about what Flanagan and Co. were going to say about what they would do at Avenge, changes in the board, etc. But then that all came back to the reality that this was a company in a lot of trouble. So they had a rights issue and another rights issue to raise money to shore up the balance sheet. And you can see since second half of 2018, the share price has been in the penny stock range. It went down to 1 cent, Stu, at one point.
I think it was, 2 cents, and they did a rights issue at 1 cent. I'm not sure if it fell to 1 cent.
But the initial rights issue. They did another rights issue at 3 cents just the other day to raise another 100 million rand, or well, I said the other day, it's 6-7 months ago. But it's been a very smart approach. So what the guys said at Avenge was, we are where we are. Let's now turn this thing around. What do we need to do? We need to sell off non-core assets. We need to raise money from shareholders to bolster the balance sheet. And we need to get our core businesses profitable. And are those core businesses worthwhile having? Certainly McConnell Dowell in Australia and Moorman's in Africa. It's a South African primarily business here, but contract mining is a fantastic business.
I'm Joshua Roberts of BizNews, and with me today is Mergence Corporate Solutions Mining Director Peter Major. Peter, we spoke yesterday following Sibanye's acquisition of a nickel and copper mine in Brazil for $1 billion. I asked you whether this would be the start of somewhat of a spending spree in the mining sector. You said they couldn't help themselves. Well, it took a day, and Implats have announced that they're in talks to acquire Royal Bafokeng Platinum. If this goes through, it's going to be a big transaction.
Yeah, it's a really big transaction. It's Rustenburg Holdings is close to 30 billion rand. I forget what Impala is, but it's multiples of that. And this one makes a lot of sense, Justin. You know, Impala tried to buy this a few years ago, and Anglo American Platinum was able to block it. And, you know, they almost blocked it out of spite. They would have got a lot of good money for it. I think later they regretted it. Anyways, now looks like no problem. Impala's been working on this quite a bit, it sounds like, because they think it's going to be done in a few more weeks. But lots of synergies here. Are they overpaying? No, not really, because even though their PE is very low, Rustenburg Holdings is even lower, Rustenburg Platinum Holdings, and it makes a lot of sense. I think it's a good deal for Impala. You know, they got big exposure in Zimbabwe. They got a decent slug of exposure in Canada. The Canadian mine is short life, you know, somewhere between 7 and 15. This mine is at least 30 years. You know, Zimbabwe, 30, 40, 50 years, 100 years. So, yes, they're putting the money in South Africa. Hopefully they get some kudos from the government, you know, some brownie points. You know, when you see Sibanye spend all this money outside, you hope Impala gets brownie points for keeping money inside. I think it's a good deal for both parties. I think government will be very happy with it. I think unions, they should be happy. Everybody should be happy with this.
How will a deal of this magnitude be structured? As you say, Rustenburg Holdings, 30 billion, 35 billion in market cap. Will this be part shares, part cash, given that Royal is on cheaper multiples, as you said?
Yeah. When it's on cheaper multiples, you don't have a problem issuing more shares because you're getting something cheaper for your high price shares. But, you know, in a way, this is like the tortoise racing the turtle. You know, when we look at PEs, because most deals done internationally, you'll see a company on a 30, 40, 50 PE buying a company on a 10 or 15, 20 PE. Here, you know, the South African version is a company on a 4.5 PE is buying out a company on a 3.5 PE. That's how it is on the mining side here, unfortunately. And Sibanye, even though they've got all this overseas exposure, they're trading on a worse PE than some South African-based precious metal companies.
Peter, we've talked, or it's been a common theme in our conversations in the last few months about the discipline of the mining executives this time around. We did say yesterday, or you said rather, that it's human nature that you can only be disciplined for so long. It's like a diet, for instance. It only lasts so long until you have that pizza or that burger and chips that ropes you in. Has the same applied here? Has this war chest of money, do they need to get their fix of M&A?
Look, I just think what Impala's done is a lot more measured. It's a lot more thought out. And I think it's easier to analyze and justify. I'm getting confused and a bit worried with some of these Sibanye acquisitions. You know, they say, hey, it's great to have exposure in different countries. But to me, well, Gold Fields proved me wrong. Gold Fields did some acquisitions in Australia that turned out okay. So I can't just flippantly say I hate buying stuff in Australia, and especially from an Australian. But it's hard to say, you know, proof is in the pudding. You wonder how long Sibanye has been working on these deals, because it's starting to look like a bit of a scatter approach. And on the surface, it definitely looks like they overpaid for that nickel mine. It looks like they overpaid for that copper mine. And, you know, I look at the grades, I really think they overpaid. I look at the life, I think they overpaid. But I'm just looking at a couple little headlines here and trying to discern what's maybe behind it. And this is a tailings operation, but when you see Appian bought this thing for 40 million, when you see Appian bought those other assets for multiples less than what Sibanye is, you wonder if Sibanye is getting stuck. Look, Neil's not dumb. He's got a sharp team, but they got some new corporate advisors outside this country that we don't know very well. And we know international corporate advisors charge a lot more than South African corporate advisors, and they feel a lot less pain, and they think they got to move quick. I've seen lots of South Africans employing overseas advisors, and I'm wary of it. But I like this deal, Impala, Rustenburg. I hate seeing another share get this delisted from here, especially in the mining space. But it's set up Impala for the future, boy.
Peter, what would be a justified premium that Impala would have to pay Royal Buffer King shareholders for them to approve this kind of deal?
Look, I see talk of 20%. And it's funny, I'm not sure if that talk of 20% was put on the market before today's stock market opened, because you can see that's exactly where the share went. I think it opened about 15%, got up to 17-18% premium. Now it's trading at a 20%. Now, the market has holes in it, so it's leaky. The fact that it's gone from 17-18 to 20 later in the day, somebody seems to have a pretty good feeling that's what is being paid, 20% of what the closing price was yesterday. I think, hate to say it's a fair premium, they both come off quite a bit. Impala has underperformed Rustenburg Baffa King Platinum by about 30% in just the last few months. So you probably would have liked to have done this deal a few months ago with a higher premium relative, but hey, you can't time these things. You know, it could be because the platinum palladium price coming off. You know, it could be because the market leaked out data and they had to announce it. Yeah. 20% premium to relative to what the two were trading. I think they'll get it. You know, I wouldn't offer more than that.
Peter, do you expect more of this type of M&A in the mining sector? I mean, we've seen two big deals already this week and it's only Wednesday.
I think so, Justin. The longer these mining companies are making this extraordinary profit, we're going to see more transactions. And look, it is a big world, and South Africans are not afraid of investing offshore. So we don't have to buy assets in this country if we find a better deal, better asset overseas. Here's the conundrum, though. Because of legislation, politics, and let's leave unions off right now temporarily, but infrastructure, Eskom, Transnet, crime, because of all the negative reasons in South Africa, we have great assets that are barely being considered and are not being taken up. And we see overseas assets that we think we can beat hands down on quality, life, and price, and they're not being taken up. And Neil Froneman's been very explicit why he doesn't want to do this, but why he's forced to. And I must agree with him pretty much why he's afraid and unwilling by his shareholders, by his board to put money in this country. He admits there's great assets here, but the environment is so toxic. It is so radioactive that people can virtually give you these assets for free, but you're still afraid to invest billions because of all the negative factors. And a lot of it is legislative. You know, if legislation is pointed correctly, then you could handle some crime, some breakdown in infrastructure, some problems at Eskom. But when the legislation is pointing to more of the negative parts, then there's no way you'll take these assets if someone gives them to you and put more money into it. And I hope government is looking at these deals and saying, we want some of this South African generated money to come back in South Africa and create more jobs. But then they must look at what their right hand's doing if it's legislating to lose jobs. You know, these gold mines lost 460,000, 480,000 employees, more to legislation than to the gold price.
Lastly, Pete, is this M&A that we're seeing now, is that indicative of the fact that we're at the top of the commodity cycle? Or is history going to paint a different picture this time around?
Look, normally, about the time the companies made super profits, the cycle was already peaking. So they were using those super profits to buy overpriced assets. But because this is the longest commodity cycle we've probably ever seen in the history of man, we can't say this is a sign that the commodity cycle has peaked. We can say that it's a sign that all the mining companies have virtually eliminated all debt. They've cleaned up their balance sheets to be so robust, so strong. They're brimming with cash. And they just think they can get better transactions rather than paying all that excess cash out on dividends. Most of them are doing both. They're paying out dividends and they're doing acquisitions. And I've seen until very recently, immense discipline has been exercised the last few years by these companies. So yeah, they could only do it for so long, but if the cash keeps rolling in, you can't fault them for doing some acquisitions because this is a long commodity cycle and they have a long period now of making super profits. But a lot of these commodities have come off, especially the PGMs, especially iron ore, coal, not quite yet. And base metals, they seem to be having their heyday. Base metals now higher than a lot of them, certainly copper and aluminum, higher than they've been in decades in real terms.
How does business empower our nation? By bringing produce to our tables, giving us technology that connects us, hospitals that care for us, and the tools that shape our cities. And by backing the next generation of business owners. That's why South Africa banks on business. Business banks on us. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized financial services and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
With me now is Michelle Patel, who is Sable International's British nationality expert. Thank you very much for your time. Michelle, let's start with the reality of getting British citizenship. Is it elusive? Is it difficult? You're here to tell us that it's actually easy, isn't it?
Yeah, I wish. Unfortunately, no. I wish I could tell you it's easy, but it's not. And I think the main reason why it's not running is because, you know, with the UK, it's one of these, well, it's, in fact, it's the only country I know that's got, you know, six different forms of its own nationality. So when you've got six different forms of nationality, you've got to understand why each and every one of them exists, how you can claim it, and how you can go about doing that. So that's why it's a little bit difficult, actually.
So Michelle, the element of Brexit, what implication has that had on your job in particular?
I think for myself in particular, I wouldn't say it's had a huge impact. On the business overall, it has had an impact. And myself, not particularly, because we weren't really connected, or the type of work I do, which is claiming or trying to isolate claims to British nationality through one's UK-born ancestors or ancestors born in previous UK territories, doesn't necessarily overlap with EU citizenship or EU citizens. However, being, Sable, we do work permits, and we have found that as soon as we left the EU, every other Italian or any, you know, Polish citizen, German citizen, all of them have had to now apply or have to apply now for a work permit to enter the UK and work here, which is why the demand for our services on our work permit business has gone up, because now we're getting more of these requests from EU citizens who traditionally, since the 1970s, never needed it. You know, it was as easy as them going from London to Birmingham if they wanted to move and live here, but now they need permission.
Has it become more and more elusive to be able to secure British citizenship? In other words, the level of difficulty, has that increased incrementally?
So, yes and no, because no, in the sense, those people who've committed to spending time in the UK and are in their immigration route to qualify for citizenship, it's pretty straightforward. You know, you have to be here for a set amount of time. You can then apply for a status and then apply for citizenship. Those are your three-step process to becoming a British citizen in what I consider a normal way of migrating. However, there is a version or a side to British citizenship, which is a little bit more outdated because it needs an understanding of the colonial laws, independence laws, et cetera, of the UK's former territories. Now, if I'm someone in South Africa that's sitting here going, well, no, my grandpa was born in the UK, but I don't want to move to the UK, but I want the citizenship. And then they approach me or my team and then we go, yeah, you could, but this is all the loopholes we have to go to get your citizenship, even though you don't really want to come reside in the UK. So that part, Brandon, it is more elusive because now I wouldn't say elusive only for the fact that it's difficult. It's because not a lot of material exists in the modern day for a layperson to go out there and research and make their own application.
Talk to me about cost. Is it prohibitive?
Yes. I mean, with the cost, how it works is if you are someone that's going, well, okay, I've got an equivalent of, I don't know, £2,000 to spend on this, then we know that, okay, you know, that will get you to where you need to be when you're looking at citizenship through ancestral connections. So you're looking at, on the high side, you're looking at around £2,000 to £2,500, more or less English pounds, if it's a very complex scenario. And this I mentioned in a case fee scenario. So something that an immigration person, in my opinion, should charge, because it's not there to exploit people. It's more or less, this is how much hours of work I need to put into this, and this is a fee per hour. So every practitioner will have a different fee per hour according to their experience and the qualifications and so on. Whereas the government, as far as the UK government is concerned, you know, realistically with these type of claims, because there's no such, there's no set fee or set form that exists for some of these claims, they usually will charge an admin fee of £80. So you're looking around £80 for some of them, and some go as high in terms of a government fee as about £1,200, depending on that kind of claim. So again, when you get a plethora of just, you know, 20 different types of claims to British citizenship, it's hard to pinpoint an exact amount one would pay unless you're just going to sit down and research their work, look into the family tree, look at what kind of claim they have.
The other important point is, of course, the value of a British passport today. Again,
yes.
Given yeah. The impact of Brexit, you
correct.
Are now constrained somewhat when it comes to travel. And I'm sure the value of a British passport has actually decreased with the advent of Brexit.
No, absolutely. I totally agree. I think it all depends on what one wants out of this situation. If someone in South Africa or anywhere in the world sitting and going, well, I know I can claim a British passport, but actually I never want to live in the UK. I wanted access to the EU. Then absolutely correct. I mean, you know, we had that scenario where I think the BBC published a year or so back that, you know, Ireland ran out of Irish passports because there were so many people applying for Irish passports, they couldn't fulfill each and every demand, and there was a big backlog because they just ran out of blank passports. It is, you're absolutely correct. I think what was once seen as a universal passport across 27 different nations is now really just for the UK and Ireland. So yes, if you are a business type, business person, then maybe you're thinking, well, I know I'm going to get an Irish passport if I can over a British passport. Now, the problem that we do have is the borders between Ireland and the UK are still very blurry. And by Ireland, I mean the Republic of Ireland. So that's still in the works, and it will depend on how those negotiations go with the EU and that hard or soft border between us and Southern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland that will really determine whether someone with ambitions of holding an Irish passport also can live in the UK and how that will go about.
Then, of course, the other question is, and I know that you are an expert in surrogacy, in adoption, when it comes to attaining
yeah.
British citizenship, is it a really difficult arena to navigate, specifically adoption and surrogacy? I suppose you can't look at them in the same light.
No, you see, well, you have a three-parent scenario, either surrogacy, or you have a scenario where it's a closed adoption. For example, we don't have the biological parents' details and so on, which still exists in the modern day. It is difficult because of the fact that you're dealing not just with the immigration and nationality law of the UK, but now you're dealing with authorities in different countries. So you've got to understand their practice. Whereas I've never done that. You know, I don't know what practices lie for a surrogate in India, for example, or so on. So that's where it makes it difficult for practitioners in the UK, because now they've got to start understanding whether this surrogacy, you know, has it happened properly with all the laws adhered to, you know, or has its adoption, is it recognized as a UK recognized adoption under the Hague Convention, and so on. But we're getting there. And the reason why we're getting there, I would say, is because people are being more ambitious with their plans. People want to have the surrogacy. People want to have the adoptions. And by people, I mean British citizens. So if I may give an example, I had a case a couple of months ago that came to me because this British couple had adopted someone in South Africa. And, you know, the adoption itself took like 18 months onwards to 2 years, because all the red tape down there. And then they went to the British High Commission. They said they couldn't help understand how to get this child over. They went to the Home Office in the UK. They called the Home Office in the UK, sorry. At that point, they couldn't help. They just said, okay, email us the inquiry. So for one of these people, it's hard to get the advice from the authorities themselves, which is where we come in. And in that case, it was as easy as making an application to the British consulate to bring the child over. And then once the child is here, I would then make an application to register the child. So the firm that I work for and myself, we've done this work we keep on pushing that envelope with the Home Office, because unfortunately, again, with the UK laws, they're not adapted to take into account three parent families, to take into account, you know, where there is a stepfather who adopted the child as compared to a full adoption, and there's a biological parent involved. So in those kind of scenarios, we're pushing the envelope to make sure that no child that's adopted is treated any different than a biological child. So in other words, if that child had been the biological child, would that child have acquired citizenship? And if the answer to that is yes, then surely by now, the UK should not discriminate against adopted children, because that's not the child's fault, is what we are saying. And we've had some success in it so far. And we're hoping that will create a new set of laws to come into practice in the UK soon to recognize that those anomalies.
Michelle, thank you so much for that update. Michelle Patel is a British nationality expert at Sable International, joining us here on BizNews.
This interview is brought to you by FirstRand.
I'm Linda from Tilburg for BizNews. Well, in March 2020, some of South Africa's richest families announced that they will be donating R1 billion each to people that were affected by the fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. It included Johan Rupert, Patrice Motsepe and Nikki Oppenheimer, with Mary Oppenheimer and her daughters adding another billion. In October 2020, in an interview with BizNews, Jonathan Oppenheimer described a decision to channel the money into a trust, which is called the South African Future Trust, which would support small, medium and micro enterprises, as an aha moment for the family. He said it took only 8 days to set up the trust, with money flowing to beneficiaries barely a week later. Well, joining me now to tell us where the money went, what effect it has had, and what's going to happen now is the head of the South African Future Trust, Bridget Fury. Hi, Bridget. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Hi, Linda.
So what happened to the money?
So yes, as you accurately described, the trust was set up. We managed to establish a public benefit organization in 7 days, and then we were very fortunate in working with the 6 major banks in South Africa to help us with the distribution of that money. So the idea was to have an interest-free loan available to small and medium-sized businesses, which met certain basic criteria. And they would take on this interest-free loan, which has a 5-year period with no requirement to pay back that money for the first 5 years. And the money then flowed directly to the employees that they had nominated into the loan agreement. And I think what we found was quite neat about this arrangement was that the SMME effectively took on the debt, albeit interest free and very concessionary, but the money actually went directly to the employees. So we specifically tried to target businesses who wanted to help their employees, who thought they had a reasonably good chance of making it through that initial lockdown period, because obviously at that stage that's all we knew that was happening, and that were kind of committed to continuing to operate into the future.
Again, I've looked at the success rate you've had. So something like, what is it, 97% of those businesses are still running?
Yeah, so just to give you some numbers, so we helped just under 10,000 small businesses. So they received loans from us, and just under 100,000 employees of those businesses. So they were typical small businesses with sort of 10 or fewer employees per business. We then did a survey of those 10,000 between October of last year and March of this year, just to ask them some questions about how they viewed the future, what were some of their current pain points, what was occupying them, and whether they thought they would be able to survive. And we were pretty astonished at that stage to see that, as you say, 97% felt that they would be able to continue operating, and that while there had been some job losses, they actually anticipated potentially growth in revenues or profits in the future. I would just make one caveat, which is that the survey happened in March of this year, and you know, in South Africa, we have seen a subsequent, very significant third wave. And so it's unclear exactly how much more devastation there will be in the SME space. But so far, they've proved to be extraordinarily resilient.
That looks amazing. And you're going into a second phase now. What does that involve?
Yeah, so obviously the money has been lent out, and it has a 5-year term. And so most of the money's been dispersed, so we don't sit with a lot of money in our bank, although interestingly we are seeing small businesses paying back. So we've had about just under 3% of the businesses have paid their loans back in full. And so we're now thinking about, so the intention when setting up this trust, it has a 20-year lifespan. The money was donated from the family into this independent trust. With the sort of initial phase was the COVID relief loan scheme, and now we're moving into a phase of how do we in the next 20 years support the growth of small businesses, given how important they are for job creation and for economic growth in our country. So we have been able to provide grants to 5 intermediary organizations who in turn work with small businesses across different sectors, one working specifically with women-owned businesses. One of the things that we've also found in our survey and others have found is that women-owned businesses typically struggle to access finance, but they are often more resilient and actually pay back the money. So we're very keen on focusing on on women-owned businesses. And then because of our requirement to get the money out very quickly in lockdown, we typically focused on more formalized businesses. And so in phase two, what we're interested in looking at is, are there informal businesses or township businesses or people that maybe weren't able to benefit from the loan, but who have great growth potential that we can work with? So we're working with an organization with a wide network of spaza shops across the country who are helping them to become more resilient and to grow. We're working with another organization that's working specifically with young business owners and women business owners in the digital space, but coming out of townships. So we're trying to diversify our approach to small business as a whole.
Well, if you said that the billion, or it's more than a billion actually, that you handed out, has been handed out, where does the money come from for the second phase?
Yeah, so we had we had 1,134,000,000 rand, so the billion rand that came from OpGen Foundation, and then we raised a little bit of additional money, and we effectively loaned out just over a billion. So we did have a little bit of the money still in the bank, so that's plus some of the money that's been paid back by the loan holders has allowed us to do these 5 initial grants to intermediaries.
How long do you think the trust would be able to go on? So as the money comes in, you would lend it out again. So it would keep on going.
Yes, I think the idea is to recycle the money. It has a fixed end date, which is 2040. So the idea is that it will by then have to have wound up and spent all this money. As you can imagine, it's very difficult to predict how much of the loan book will be paid back and what the default rates are likely to be. So far, it's looking very positive. I think Jonathan, Nikki and his family, when they first set it up, their view was that, you know, they could be looking at upwards of 50% of the loan book not being recovered. But I think we are much, much more optimistic given what we are hearing from small businesses. So yes, I mean, there's no point in us sitting on money. So as money gets paid back by loan holders, we will then be able to provide either lend it out or to provide grants to organizations who are in turn helping businesses.
Well, thanks for being with us. From me and the rest of the BizNews team, we'll see you same time, same place tomorrow. Cheerio.
You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at BizNews.